time for The Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cycling, and related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist on-air show is heard every Saturday morning, 7:30 a.m. in northeastern Ohio on WJCU 88.7 FM and streamed at WJCU.org. Our weekly podcast is available at the close of the on-air show at OutspokenCyclist.com or download it with your favorite podcatching app to listen anytime. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Hello and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks. This is our show for February 15th, 2020. Once again, it's time for Radiothon. Beginning yesterday, Valentine's Day, and continuing through Sunday, February 23rd, we're asking for your support for WJCU. WJCU hosts the Outspoken Cyclist radio show and podcast, and we only come to you once a year to ask for help. All of the money that is pledged during Radiothon goes directly to support the station. With it, we're able to upgrade our equipment, make any necessary repairs, and purchase supplies for our staff. WJCU offers a huge variety of shows, from talk to sports to music, and it's all commercial free. It's a worthy cause, and any amount you wish to donate will be most appreciated. So why don't you call in right now, 216-397-4438, or you can log on to WJCU.org and go directly to the Radiothon online form. That's 216-397-4438. As we like to say, operators are standing by. Actually, I always wanted to say that. Any amount will be greatly appreciated. We have some lovely gifts to show our appreciation, too. So let's get to this week's show. Every once in a while, I have the privilege of speaking with someone who has made a contribution to our sport, and in this case, to many sports, that has literally changed the way people participate. Robin Thurston is the new CEO of Pocket Outdoor Media. It's home to Velo News, Velo Press, Triathlete, Women's Running, Bicycle Retailer and Industry News, and more. Robin started out in finance. Well, he started out as a pro racer back in the 80s, but when he ended up in the back of a support vehicle by way of the rear windshield, he came back to the U.S. from Europe and began his professional off-the-bike career. But on a cycling trip in Europe, he was asked a question that would change the way we think about traveling by bike, and I'll let him tell you the rest. After the break, we'll head to the Big Apple to speak with Brian Miller. He's the importer for Iriday USA. The classic Italian brand of hand-built steel bikes will be exhibiting at NABS in Dallas next month. Brian tells us about the Giamattis, the family that started the brand in 1919 and still operates the factory today. So let's head on out to Colorado to speak with Robin Thurston. Hi, Robin. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for being on the show this week.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
It is my pleasure, actually. So I want to talk about your current gig, Pocket Outdoor Media, but I'd like to get a little of your background because I know that this is a new place for you. I'd like to know where you grew up, where you went to school, and of course, how you became interested in cycling.
So I grew up in Denver, Colorado. I would say I was sort of part of the, you know, the 80s cycling movement. So what I mean by that is there was a lot of other riders at that time that were sort of coming up. So like I was racing with Jonathan Vaughters and Bobby Julich and Clark Sheehan and a whole number of people that were, you know, sort of in this Colorado system and racing community. And when I saw the world championships in 83, I think that for me was sort of sealed the deal. But I think the Tour de France is in 85 and 86 were, you know, I mean, you know, certainly sort of created the heroes for me of the sport. And so I wanted to be a pro cyclist. And growing up in Colorado, I was a good climber. And I would say even to this day, I haven't lost my passion for riding. So that's sort of the, that was sort of the early years. I went to Europe and raced from 90 to 94 and you know, I'd say just had a mediocre career at some level. And, you know, I was in Switzerland racing for Helvetia Lugano and teammates like Oscar Kammensteen and Armin Meyer and a number of other people. And I had a fairly famous mentor slash coach, a guy named Urs Zimmermann, who finished third in the Tour de France in 86 and was a runner-up in the Giro a number of times. So I was lucky in that I had very good people around me and mentors. And, you know, I think I grew up in a time when cycling, road cycling, was really exploding from an American perspective. So, you know, and then I retired. I unfortunately went through the back windshield of a team car at about 40 miles an hour, no helmet. And luckily I recovered, but it was definitely a pretty traumatic injury. So I sort of hung up my wheels in 94. And, you know, that was kind of when I started my professional career, my working career, I guess I'd say.
So that sounds like a Davis Finney move, as I remember. He did something similar.
It's very, very, very similar.
Yeah.
Very similar.
Yeah.
Well,
I'm glad to hear that you came out okay. I mean, clearly here you are. And you've done some very interesting things since then. Let me take a moment to remind my listeners we're speaking with Robin Thurston. He is currently brand new, the CEO of Pocket Outdoor Media. We'll talk about that a little bit later. But you were one of the original founders of Map My Fitness, which is the foundation for apps such as Map My Ride, etc. So how did you get into that from being a cyclist? That's pretty interesting.
I was a finance, both undergrad and graduate major, so I wouldn't say I was an engineer at all. But my early career in the internet, I spent 14 years working in finance, but I had a lot of exposure to building web-based applications. I was essentially product managing a number of applications that varied from, you know, tools for financial advisors to Reuters.com. I was involved with because I was at Reuters for almost 10 years. So I was in and around the media business and building web applications that, you know, had scale to them and you know, really had to think about usability by the, you know, the consumer or the you know, the business owner who might be using them. So basically, I've been doing that most of my financial career, whether that was at Reuters or, you know, I worked for Wellington Management in Boston. So when I founded MapMy, I was actually on a cycling trip in Europe. And, you know, basically there was a whole bunch of Americans and Europeans sitting around a dinner table, and somebody said, oh, it would be great if I could come back to Switzerland, because we were in this tiny little town called Andermatt. And they were like, it'd be great if I could come to Switzerland and know the routes that you have showed me on this, you know, this trip we've taken together. And I immediately was like, you know, there's nothing there. There were travel books for cycling, you know, but there was nothing where if I wanted to share a route with you, Diane, that I could easily do that in a sort of web-based format. And so I wrote on the trip, I was still in Europe, I bought the domain Map My Ride, I, you know, wrote this huge product specification document. I came back to the States and I hired a couple of friends of mine in Boulder who were engineers to start building Map My Ride. And, you know, basically I was in that process. I launched the first version of Map My Ride, and a friend of mine who lived in Boulder, who ran a web development company called Wall Street on Demand, he said to me, he was a big runner, and he goes, what's the name of your website? And I said, well, it's called Map My Ride. And he goes, that's weird. I think there's a Map My Run. And I was like, what? Because I wasn't a runner at all. Like, I had no running background at all. So I went online right after I left the lunch, and I reached out to my other co-founder, Kevin Callahan, who was a sort of a beach bum working for an SEO company. He was a John Hopkins engineer grad. So he was a coder, and I reached out to Kevin and I just said, you know, do you want to sell me your website? Cause I didn't really want there to be two brands out there. And he was like, yeah, sure, I'll sell you the website. So we went through the purchase agreement, and I was going to buy Map My Run from him. And he had built this sort of like really sort of click utility for how to create maps. so then one of my engineers in Boulder quit. And I, so I immediately called Kevin back and I was just like, hey, you know, instead of me buying this, you just want to become my partner in building this out. And so that was, and that was well before the iPhone or, you know, it was just a web-based application that allowed you to share routes. And then we started doing things like training plans and we built a whole bunch of functionality around, you know, like route discovery and workout discovery and things like that. So it was a little bit serendipitous that Kevin and I met. He was living in San Diego. We then set the company up in Colorado and I was still living in Boston at the time. So then we sort of centered everything back in Colorado and we decided to, you know, move everybody here. And we were pretty small. We had, the team was like 7-8 people. And basically we thought it was going to be a little bit of a hobby business. Like I didn't really think it was going to be something big. And then we ended up developing an iPhone application for the launch of the App Store in July of 2008. And that was sort of the, like at first, actually, people were like, oh, it must have been amazing. You were one of the first apps in the store. And I always joke like, yeah, we were. But the reality, it was crickets actually the first like 3 or 4 months. We were doing maybe like 1,000 downloads a week or something like that. Like it just wasn't a lot of people. And then a friend of mine called me on, I think it was November 4th of 2008. The markets were melting down. You know, the world was going to fall apart. And he said, have you seen the Wall Street Journal today? And I was like, no. And he goes, have you seen the New York Times? And I was like, no. And he's like, well, you know, USA Today. I was like, no. And he goes, well, you should get them all. And I was like, okay. So I was still at Wellington at the time. I went downstairs and I looked at them and they all had these huge AT&T ads for the iPhone, because it was an AT&T exclusive at that time.
Right.
And they had Matt My Ride was one of the icons on the visual for the phone. And we literally went from like a trickle of downloads to like hundreds of thousands of downloads a day. I mean, it was insane. And we didn't even know Apple was going to do it. Like they just call you and they say, send us some artwork. We had no idea what they were going to use the artwork for. Zero idea.
Wow.
And that was really the catalyst for MapMy being, you know, like I would argue not only one of the first apps in the store, but, you know, one of the great use cases of the iPhone, which was leveraging the GPS from the phone to, you know, allow people to basically go out and map. And, you know, instead of buying a Garmin, you know, you just use the phone out on a ride. And there were a lot of problems in the early days, like the GPS destroyed the bat, like would drain the battery.
Right.
Things like that. But, you know, we just sort of capitalized on that sort of shift of people, you know, taking their phones and with their, whether it was riding, running, you know, hiking, whatever it was. And that was really the catalyst for the growth of MapEye. And then we were in Denver and we moved the business to Austin, Texas, because we took our first funding. And, you know, then it was sort of off to the races from there.
Wow, what an amazing story. Let me remind our listeners again, we're speaking with Robin Thurston, clearly one of the founders of MapMy, MapMy Ride, his partner MapMy Run, MapMy Fitness. So, okay, I think I know what happened. MapMy got bought out.
Yeah, I got a call one day from Kevin Plank at Under Armour, and he called me directly. He got my number through somebody and he called me and he goes, oh, you know, this is Kevin Plank. And I was like, oh, hi, Kevin Plank. I didn't really know that much about Under Armour. And he goes, you know, I love your app. I use it every day. Cause he was, you know, running a lot and training for various events and stuff. And he goes, you know, I use your app all the time. And so he's like, what are you going to do with it? And I was like, well, you know, we're trying to build a really big sports brand. And, you know, at that time we had, I think, close to 20 million users. And basically he was like, well, you know, I want you to come to Baltimore and, you know, see what we're doing. And we know we got to get into digital. And, you know, we really think, you know, you have this great platform for us to be able to do that. And so the whole transaction, like from the time I met Kevin in September or August to when we sold the company was 90 days.
Wow.
I mean, it was like really, it was very, very fast how quickly everything happened. And Kevin and I had, like, I mean, I really have a tremendous amount of loyalty to Kevin. I mean, not, I mean, obviously he changed my life, but, you know, Under Armour and what we did there, I think was a you know, I think there will be case studies written about how companies should be thinking about digital and get into digital. And so that I got there, I became chief digital officer, and then we put together a strategy to go out and buy MyFitnessPal and Endomondo. And there were, you know, a number of other companies that we bought and sort of rolled under the connected fitness platform. So I was there for 3 years and had a great time. It was, you know, really an unbelievable time in the company, in Under Armour's history, and was able to really, you know, do something that I wanted to do, which was build a very big platform. And today there's, you know, I think there's 275 million users on the connected fitness platform. It's by far the largest, you know, fitness platform in the world, you know, and covers everything from diet to, you know, all different types of activities to connected shoes to, it's really amazing actually what's been built and how they've continued to maintain it. And a lot of the people from MapMy are still there, whether they're in Austin or San Francisco from MyFitnessPal. So it's continued very nicely, which certainly is makes me happy.
Once again, we're speaking with Robin Thurston. We're going to take a real short break, and when we come back, we're going to ask him about a company called Helix, just briefly, because we want to talk about Pocket Outdoor Media. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
We're back. If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Robin Thurston. He's the CEO of Pocket Outdoor Media, and we'll get to all the different publications and brands that come underneath that. Before we took a break, we were talking about your MapMy. You sold it. You moved on. Tell me about Helix, because there's a different kind of company, and I'm always fascinated by genetics. What is Helix? How did you become involved with it?
Yeah, so I had a 5-year non-compete.
Sure.
With Under Armour. So I had to take a couple of years where I really couldn't operate in the space. And so I wanted to do something different. You know, if I sort of think through my history, I had built several financial platforms, a fitness platform. And when I was approached by Illumina, who is the parent company of Helix, they essentially make the machines that process DNA. When I was approached by Illumina and Warburg Pincus to become the CEO, I as I started to do my research, I became really fascinated about the idea or concept that they had come up with, which was essentially that, you know, that if you look at the technology that 23andMe or Ancestry is using to do genealogy, it's actually a pretty limited data set of your genetic information. And so what Helix was going to do was run essentially what's called your exome, or, you know, you could call it your whole genome, a much, much larger data set that the consumer themselves would own and then would decide to unlock through partners that we had built on top of the platform. So like if you want a genealogy, you would, you know, download Geographic app and allow them to access a certain portion of your genetic information. If you wanted a Mayo Clinic analysis, you know, called Gene Guide, you would again buy that consumer. And so it was essentially a marketplace built on top of your whole genome so that you could decide as a consumer what you want, what information you wanted to access or not access. So if you don't want to learn about cancer in the Helix system, you don't have to, because you can essentially, you know, not subscribe to or download that partner application. And so I thought it was super interesting because the data was very clean. It processed all in the same lab that was a Helix lab. You know, the partnerships were super interesting. People like Mayo Clinic and PerkinElmer and, you know, Lose It and, you know, all kinds of people that had built applications on the platform. So this genetic platform, I thought was like the next super cool, super interesting challenge, you know, along this pattern of building platforms we were able to launch the platform in the consumer space. But what we realized very quickly was that there was a lot of demand for running large scale genetic information for like hospital systems or states or countries. And so the business pivoted to being a B2B business pretty early in its, you know, sort of in its lifetime. And so I just felt like I wanted to build consumer applications. And so it just wasn't exactly the right fit for me. And that's why after 3 years, I decided to bow out and let one of our board members take the CEO position and move on. But I think it was also an itch that I had to get back into the, you know, sort of sports space. I get a lot of energy from the sports and fitness category. I know it's my calling. And so I was sort of itching to get back into the category, you know, after having been at Helix for 3 years.
Wow, what a story! I'm really loving it.
But by the way, it was probably one of the weaknesses. Is I think the only biology class I ever had in school, I got a C in, and so I would say I always felt a little bit out of, you know, a little bit of fish out of water. I learned a tremendous amount, and we had amazing scientists working at Helix, and I'm so proud of what the team accomplished there. But it was a stretch for me, you know, and I really had to learn a lot to, you know, to participate and really be active in the company because, like I said, molecular biology was not my strong suit.
Yeah, I got it. I got it. Well, I guess that pretty much brings us up to date with history, and suddenly you are now sort of this overlord of this group of products in the sports space, including Velo News, Velo Press, Bicycle Retailer, Women's Running, Podium Runner, I think it's called. So what the hell got you into this?
So I had been, you know, I guess I'd say sort of dabbling and making some investments. There's another company that we're going to announce soon that we merged in, an event company, basically that, you know, was in the event space, has events in Colorado like Elephant Rock and Tour of the Moon and Copper Triangle, some very, very big cycling events that I had invested in a few years earlier with a couple of partners. And so when Felix McGowan reached out to me, you know, clear that after they got Pocket Outdoor Media back from Competitor Group, that they had to figure out how to go digital. And so, you know, Felix asked me to join the board, and I said, look, I'm willing to join the board if at some point down the road I could take a majority ownership in the company. And so we came to an agreement about how that would work. And so I joined the board, and, you know, I started, you know, I guess I'd say investing a little bit of time. And I would say that one of the things at Under Armour that I felt was always a little bit of unfinished business was I really wanted to get in the content space. Like I really wanted to do a lot more content because I knew it was hard, but I knew if you did it really high quality content that you could, you know, do some really interesting stuff and really provide, you know, something to consumers that you can't get in many places. You know, I was starting to invest a little bit of time in understanding what Pocket was doing and the content and the publications, which, by the way, I had been reading Velo News since 81 or 82.
When they were in Brattleboro, Vermont.
Yeah, I mean, I had been reading these for a very, very long time. So I was very familiar with the brands, for sure. So I was trying to understand the content and editorial process. And I think I just really, during that, you know, sort of the board tenure, I just really realized like how big of an opportunity there was. Like I was like, wow, there, you know, and I started really reconstructing and thinking about what we had done right at MapMy and maybe things that I wish we would have done. And, you know, so I looked at Pocket, I looked at the event business, and I just thought, you know, like there's still a big, big opportunity in the market to do something very unique from a customer perspective in building great technology and allowing access to this content and experiences in a way that no one had done it before. And so, you know, I called Felix after I knew I was leaving Helix, and I said, look, I'd be very interested in my wife and I wanted to move back to Boulder because, you know, I'm from here, and we had lived here when we first got married, and we got married at the St. Julian just down the street from where the office is and where we live now. I just got really excited about the business. And so that was sort of the catalyst for, you know, coming back, you know, to Colorado and getting much more involved in Pocket. You know, so that was really the, you know, sort of switch and, you know, wanting to get back into the sport.
I'm going to play devil's advocate for a second, just mm-hmm. to mess with you a little bit.
Sure.
I've been in the bicycle business for many, many years. So I grew up during the time of Bicycle Dealer Showcase. Harcourt Brace owned the trade show at the time. It then became Steve Reddy and Interbike. And I'm looking yep. at the bicycle business from probably a different perspective, that inside from the retailer perspective. And it's so dysfunctional in so many ways. I mean, I see it that way. I've seen it that way. And I'm wondering if you think there's something that Pocket can bring to it with something like Bicycle Retailer and Industry News that's going to maybe bring it into the 21st century.
Maybe the way I'd frame this up is I agree with you. I think there are, I mean, and I don't think it's actually unique just to the cycling business. I think that the running business and the triathlon business has, you know, they have similar challenges in that they're incredibly fragmented. In some ways, my analogy is that if you look in the road, I'd say this is more on the road side. But if you look at what in the late 80s, 90s in cycling clubs, there was a lot of this like, oh, I don't like this person, so I'm just going to go form my own club. And so there was like a lot of fragmentation in running clubs, cycling clubs, because people would just go and they'd go find some small sponsors and, you know, get a deal from a clothing manufacturer and boom, they have their club up because, you know, one person didn't like the other person that much and they didn't want to ride together anymore. They didn't want to run together anymore. And, you know, I think that there are signs of that even in the business side of things. And I think that's one of the reasons why there's a lot of fragmentation. So, you know, my view is that I believe there's going to be not only much better technology that facilitates and brings these worlds together, but that there will be a lot of consolidation. And I think the right vision, you know, and leadership to an organization can fundamentally, you know, I guess they'd say bring it into the 21st century. And so, you know, my goal right now is like to build a great team. You know, build really, really, really good technology that enables people to get access to the content and the experiences in a way that they haven't before. And that I do think that that will attract and bring companies together from a consolidation perspective. And, you know, my hope is that, you know, that's something that at Pocket that we'll be able to do, not just in the media space, but, you know, potentially in other verticals like the, you know, like the event space and some other areas. I remember speaking at the Bicycle Leadership Conference in, gosh, it was probably 2010 in Monterey when I was at MapMy. And I remember somebody asking basically like, oh, you know, it's really cool technology. And I said, you know, at that time, I think we had 15 million email addresses and a tremendous amount of detail on, you know, cyclists and what they were actually doing and not surveys, but like how many miles were they actually riding and where were they riding and, you know, where were they running and things like that. And I think there was some fear about that at the time. Like people were like, oh, you know, like, you have all this data and, you know, like my feeling is that there is ways to help everyone in the industry. So like, I think even when you look at when Competitor Group bought POC or what was at the time called Inside Communications,
right.
I think a lot of people were very worried about what Competitor Group was up to, especially in the running space. Like all the running events thought that they were basically just going to eat everyone up and destroy the market share. And frankly, it just helped the entire business grow. So, you know, I really do feel that building a great experience, building a great team and, you know, frankly, bringing people together is what is going to revolutionize and kind of bring us into the next, you know, the next decade, the next, you know, two decades for the sport.
Let me remind our listeners again, we're speaking with Robin Thurston. He's the CEO of Pocket Outdoor Media. It owns Bicycle Retailer and Industry News, Velo News, Triathlete. I forgot that Triathlete was one of the one of your products, too. And women's running and podium running, some really interesting products that go along with sports the way we know them. The people who listen to this show know them also. So I guess one of my questions is about whether print is still going to be viable. I still get a Bicycle Retailer. I know people still get a Velo News. I know Sea Otter's going to be sending out all of their guides with them in the next, whatever it is, month. Where does print fall into your idea of building this sort of new digital platform?
Well, I certainly don't think print is dead. I mean, I mean, it's interesting. You have big publications that are shutting down, you know, magazines left and right. You know, I don't think print is dead. I mean, we also have a book business called Bella Press that has a couple hundred titles in it that, you know, we print books and, you know, do that through partnerships and distribute those. You know, I think that you have to have all mediums. And what I mean by that is that the consumer today expects that if they read something in print, that they can go find that and, you know, search for it and get it online or vice versa, you know, rapidly. And maybe that there's even an audio version of it in a podcast format or, you know, something like that. So I really think that all content needs to be built in all mediums so that consumers can access it the way that they want it. But I don't think print's dead at all. And I think a lot of it has to do with packaging. I think a lot of it has to do with how you bring your assets together and distribute those to the end customer so that they maximize the value out of it. So I'm very, you know, I think it'll be interesting to watch what happens as the, you know, mobile and web applications get better and better, you know, like at Pocket, and whether or not consumers still will demand the print, you know, in the next couple of years. But as of right now, I mean, we have, you know, tens of thousands of subscribers of all the magazines, and, you know, and we distribute hundreds of thousands of copies. And, you know, the reality, like, is I don't think it's going anywhere in the short term. But it is, to me, about delivering the content in all mediums, whether that's video, podcasts, you know, audio for books. You really have to produce these things in all mediums based on how consumers are engaging with the content these days.
Well, you certainly do have what I would call a worldview. It's really such a pleasure to talk with you and hear all these things. I've been kind of cynical about the business because it seems to get mired in its own stuff, so to speak, over the years. So it's nice to hear somebody who's got some optimism. So what is immediately next for you? Do you have the next thing already in place? I know you're talking about events.
Yeah, I mean, we do. You know, we've raised a fair amount of capital to invest in the technology. So I think you'll see a lot of that from us this year.
Good.
As we roll out new things, you know, we're excited to get those in the hands of consumers and get their feedback as quickly as possible. You know, I think we will continue to evaluate and look at how I believe the industry is going to come together. And, you know, we're just excited about, you know, one is, I mean, I'm maybe optimistic to a flaw. So hopefully I can bring that to not just cycling, but all of these categories, and that will attract the best talent in the industries to come and join me in building this vision that I have for what I think things are going to look like down the road. But I would just say in the short run, it's really about, you know, getting the consumer much better technology and do it and delivering content in a whole variety of mediums as quickly as possible whether the news comes or, you know, the story comes out, you know, so that we can, you know, attract those customers to want to come to Pocket before they go other places to go, you know, potentially get other types of content. I would say a lot of it this year is about tech and a lot about building teams so that we can build this vision that, you know, essentially we share at Pocket over the next, you know, decade.
It has just been a pleasure to speak with you. Are you going to be at Sea Otter?
I'm hoping to come in for one day, so I hope to meet you there.
Yeah, I hope so. You come by the media tent. I'd love to meet you in person. And I appreciate you spending so much time talking with me today. We've been talking with Robin Thurston. He is the CEO of Pocket Outdoor Media.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
All right. You take care. Robin Thurston joined me from the offices of Pocket Outdoor Media. I, for one, am looking forward to watching his vision unfold for the cycling industry. His past successes certainly bode well for the future. So let's take a break, and when we come back, we'll talk about Iriday USA and learn what Iriday means. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
We're back, and I'd like to remind you once again that it's Radiothon. Please help us to reach our goal of $50,000 in our 50th year of broadcasting. Call 216-397-4438 and pledge your support. Or you can log on to wjcu.org and go directly to the online donation form. We appreciate any amount you're willing to pledge. Before we talk with Brian Miller from Iriday USA, I'd like to relay a story from this past Sunday that will illustrate how bike law can assist if you find yourself in need of legal advice. Last Sunday, when teenager Javier Lopez was riding off the front of a group of cyclists in Florida with another rider, he rolled through a stop sign. And the policeman who stopped them decided to handcuff Javier, put him in the back of his car, and take him to jail. Bail was set at $8,500. While no one will argue that rolling through a stop sign is okay, making an example of the young man who is still only a teenager, and who, after watching the dash cam and body cam, was confused and upset, not understanding what he had done that would cause the officer to arrest him, bike law was the next call that was made. The Florida Office of Bike Law immediately took the case and began an independent investigation into what happened. If you're interested in following Javier's case, you can log on to Bike Law's Facebook page. Or for more information, you can log on to bikelaw.com. Brian Miller has the great good fortune to travel to Italy at least twice a year. He imports Iriday, the Italian brand of fine, handcrafted bicycles that have been produced by the same family since 1919. Hello, Brian. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show this week.
Thanks for having me.
It's my pleasure. We're getting ready for the North American Handmade Bike Show in March. I wanted to chat with you about your traditional Italian handmade bicycles from Iriday. And it's Iriday USA. Tell me about it.
Well, what would you like to know? There are many details.
Everything. So I guess let's start with a background on the brand, where it started and how it started, and then we'll talk about the family that started it.
Okay. Well, it started in northern Italy. In around 1919, Umberto Giamatti started his factory, Giamatti Velocipedi. Produced a few brand names. Iriday has always been the highest performance of the brands that came out of the Giamatti Velocipedi factory. It's located in a little town called Cintello di Tellio Veneto. It's in the Veneto, the state of where the city of Venice is located. It's northeast of Venice.
It's not sinking into the water?
Nope.
That's good.
No, it's not. Not on an island. It's on the land.
When I think back over the many years I've been in the bike business, I know there's some unique characteristics about Italian bikes. I mean, people say they ride differently. They ride specially. tell me what the quality is of the Iriday brand that has made it so long-lived. There are not a lot of Italian brands still being at least exported to the U.S. as far as I know.
Right, right. There was a lot of consolidation. And the only major is Bianchi. But, you know, the Columbus and the Chianelli are excellent as well. But traditionally, the Italian bicycles have always been they've been designed to have very sporty handling and yet be comfortable and intuitive to handle and operate. And that's a depiction of the Italian culture in general. And we take advantage of that and do that the best that we can with that. And our Iriday bikes are a good balance of the traditional and the advanced. We keep an eye on the traditional things. Many aspects of bicycle design have already been figured out. And then we use the most advanced things that are an improvement on those traditional elements.
Looking at the bike, they look pretty traditional. They're lugged, they're steel. Most of them, or many of them, have steel forks. Some, of course, are using carbon. What are some of the more recent innovations that have been incorporated into the frames?
Really, it is the materials of the carbon fiber. All the bikes everyone buys them from the website, and they come with a number of options, and that's one of the options, to get a carbon fiber fork or the traditional steel fork. The carbon fiber fork is much lighter weight, and the aspects of the plastic add an enhancement to the ride feel. The center of the frame with the mass, and that's where all the steel is and all of your control, has the aspects of steel, the spring in your step sort of feel, the return of the power with the flexing, and then the plastic on the front end, and then also we like to use it in the seat post, dampens out the bits of vibration. It doesn't ring like the metal does. So it reduces the fatigue of the buzz of going over pavement.
So are all these bikes made to order? So let's say somebody chooses one of the bikes on the site, and I do know they come in sizes. Are the frames already made up and then they're painted, or will they be made once somebody says, I want that one?
No, they're made to order, and custom geometry is one of the options, though I must say almost no one orders it. Everyone orders the off-the-shelf geometry, which is excellent. One of the interesting things that almost everyone does order is the option to have their name painted on the frame.
I understand that. I do. I see that a lot. And you know what? It's a nice thing to do. First of all, it's easier to identify your bike, and other people, they'll walk up to you and go, oh, your name doesn't look like it's Irene, you know, if it gets stolen.
Right. And that's one of the things that the Italians traditionally do, monogram a bicycle for somebody. And so we keep that up. And since they are made to order, we can offer that, and people like it.
Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Brian Miller. He is with Iriday USA, which is, I assume, the importer for the brand here in the States?
Right.
So it sounds to me like you speak Italian. Do you speak Italian?
I do.
Hmm.
It's required in some cases, but, you know, I speak Italian like a gorilla. But,
An Italian gorilla, okay.
Right.
How long does it take to get one of the bikes once somebody places an order on the site?
Well, we usually try to hit about 6 weeks, and often do. Though sometimes there are delays. So,
are you being hit with any tariffs? Is that a problem for you? Well, actually, no. You're not coming from China. You're coming from Italy. That shouldn't be an issue, right?
Right. And that, you know, the tariffs have been hitting random things like wine and cheese and whatever.
Hmm. But not bicycles out of Italy.
It does mix into some of the things that with some of the parts, you know, because it's a global product.
Are you delivering complete bikes?
Yeah, we're selling complete bikes now. We have offered frames, but the bikes are the best way to get.
And are they Campi, Shimano? How are they equipped?
Well, we like to use Miki components. They're very good, and they're nearby, and they deliver quickly. And they are friendly. Campagnolo is an excellent company. They make excellent components, but, you know, not so friendly, not so speedy. But Miki, very good. So So we try to use Miké components, and then we also use the American components, like on the Roadster, the multi-speed Roadster. We use grip shift, SRAM drivetrain on the rear, because that's the only place to get it.
And it is interesting that you do not have like 25 different models. You only have a few, and clearly you're targeting specific markets. What are you targeting? Who are you targeting?
Well, those are two different aspects there. We target people who appreciate the heritage and the pedigree of an old world family history with ancestral spells mixed into the bikes. And we recognize that not everyone appreciates that. But for the people who do appreciate that, there's just about no other better place to get an authentic, real, traditional bike that's been, has the family secrets passed down. But then about the limited number of models, yes, we only want to portray what the expertise is. It would be dishonest to offer every different type of bike. I have experience in mountain bikes and even BMX, for example, but it would be dishonest to have an Iriday freestyle bike or BMX bike. It would be damn cool. It would be the best one available, but it's not really the expertise that we want to portray, that we can express with the knowledge that's already available.
So who is your customer? Who's your client?
Well, people who appreciate the history of things, and Italian Americans often, and actually we have a big following in Korea.
Interesting.
Yeah. Again, it's the respect for the heritage.
You and I, in our previous conversations getting ready for our interview today, talked about a book that was just published about the Giamattis and their bicycles.
Oh, yeah.
First of all, you're going to have to pronounce the name of the book because it was totally unpronounceable to me. It is also, I think, a PDF online. You can buy it that way. And is it translated into English or is it strictly in Italian right now?
Well, the title is actually phonetic. The words are pretty simple. Un romanzo in otto tubi. It's a novel in eight tubes. Referencing the bike frame.
Right.
And it covers the history, you know, the colorful history of the early parts of the Umberto Giamatti's company, and then Carlos, and then his son, Mario, taking over the company. And then currently Carlo Giamatti is wielding the torch in the factory today, and he's the grandson of Umberto. And the book is tells the story of the region around there, and it's nice, it's a colorful thing. And the written by Alberto Nisani, and it's a PDF, and it can be found around on the internet. Search for Romanzo in Otto Tubi.
We'll put that up on our social media so people can look for
it. Okay, good.
Yeah.
It's many places the PDF is free and you can download it and look at it. And it's easy to run through Google Translator. And you can get a good feel for it. It's easy to read that way.
Once again, we're speaking with Brian Miller. He is the importer for Iriday USA, a line of Italian bikes that will be at NABS. Is this your first North American handmade bike show?
No, we are very experienced at the Handmade Bike Show.
Why do I not know that? I guess I should. So what
do
you think?
Well, you know.
I mean, I've been there more than once.
We don't do any fat bikes. We do all skinny bikes.
We don't do that. Not everybody does fat bikes, but that's a good answer. I like that. Tell me what you'll be bringing.
Well, we're going to have a new fixed gear and a new roadster, a multi-speed roadster. With the large diameter tube option, which is new, we've been making frames with oversized tubes, as well as the standard super skinny 1-inch tubes.
What does Carlo think about brazing up these bigger tube frames? Does it do anything with his history?
Well, it takes a lot of cajoling to get him to try something. It did take him a while to find all the, you know, the oversized lugs and the tubes, but we get everything from Columbus and they have it all, the tubes. And then he started to do it and he likes it. And so.
Well, that's good. So you do use, you use Columbus Tubing SLX or whatever?
Yeah. We use, it's SL, yeah.
SL. Nice. Well, one of the things that I think is nice about your line is it is not meant for the, and you'll excuse the expression, balls out racer. It is meant for people who just want to enjoy a fine Italian bike and maybe ride it on the street.
Right. That's an important aspect. You know, we make high performance, non-competitive bikes. You could race with these bikes, but that's not what they're for. They're for high performance general riding, for casual or, you know, fast riding. But with one of the important aspects of the high performance is when it's easier to pedal, when it's easier to ride fast, you use less energy and you arrive with less perspiration.
And what I'm hearing here is transportation.
Yeah, well, indeed. To go ride to the bar, go ride to the movies, go visit your friends, that's what these are all about. We put pedals on so you can wear normal shoes, so you can wear normal clothes and go do something. That's the idea.
I like that. Well, the website's quite comprehensive. You can look at the bikes, you can buy them online. And is that the only place? You do not have dealers.
Right. We don't, you know, have that kind of volume to fill up all the bike stores in America.
Well, that's an interesting point. Yep, yep. Do you usually write business at the show?
Do I usually what?
Write business. Do you usually get orders at the show?
Oh, sometimes. Sometimes there's a referral from a shop or somebody says, you know, where can I get one of these? I read about it.
Nice.
And we send bikes to bike shops to have them finished. And then the customer picks them up there. That's one of the ways. Though many people order the home delivery option.
Hmm.
Where we'll build it up and we deliver it right to the house.
So how many bikes does the factory produce a year, or can the factory produce a year?
Well, it can easily do one a day. But also the factory in Italy does a number of other bikes for the local market there. You know, one of the more common types of bicycling in Italy is older people. They're retired and they ride the bikes in the center of town and they hang around in the squares and talk with their friends and smoke cigarettes and stand over their bicycles. It's great. that's a big market of bicycles there. And there's a wider range. The USA project is just for the high-end bicycles, the handmade.
Ah, I see. I see. How often do you get over to Italy?
Oh, twice a year at least.
Nice. Nice.
Yeah, it's not bad. Good living there.
I see. You know, there's some really cute things on the website, some nice things. You can see something called spare frames. So just kind of stacked up against a wall.
Right.
Some of the lugs. Spicy advertising. That's kind of cute. Just some nice stuff. It's very traditional. I like traditional stuff. Tell our listeners how they can find out more about Iridei.
Well, the website does have all the goods. It's iridaiusa.com. But, you know, another word about the name.
Yes.
It's rumor has it that a woman that Umberto knew. That's a bit scandalous, but it means the rainbow colors that are associated with the winning flag. You often see them on bicycle merchandise, on shoes and clothing. There's a tag of a bunch of striped colors.
Yeah, the world championship stripes.
Sure.
Yeah.
Exactly. And that's the Iridei.
Whoa.
That's the rainbow of colors. And it also means the iris of the eye. That's the more common use for the word. But
when people look at it, they're going to say it says I Ride USA. So we want to make sure that that's not what they say. Iridei.
Yes, it's Iridei. But the I Ride thing is not offensive. It's kind of funny. Certainly in 1919, there was no need for a market line of iPhones and iPads to associate with. And also, there's not a word for ride in Italian. they wouldn't even get the pun if it was intended. You told them.
What's the word for getting on your bike?
You have to go by bicycle, or go by horse, or go by motorcycle.
Oh, interesting.
You can pedal a bicycle. There's a verb for pedal, but there's no word for ride.
Isn't that interesting?
But we certainly don't mind if people say I ride. If it helps you remember the website address, it is a lot easier. iRideUSA.com.
Well, Brian Miller, iRideUSA.com. He'll be at the North American Handmade Bike Show to show you these lovely Italian machines. Thank you so much for talking with me. Good luck at the show this year. I don't know if I'm going to get myself down there, but if I do, I'll stop by the booth and say hello.
Okay. Well, call me anytime. I love talking about bikes.
I could tell. Thanks, Brian. I appreciate it. Have a great day.
Okay, you too.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Brian Miller joined me from his office in New York City at iRideUSA USA. If you're interested in learning more about the brand, you can log on to irideusa.com. And if you're planning on attending the North American Handmade Show in Dallas next month, why don't you stop by his booth, ogle the lovely machines, and tell Brian that you heard our conversation on the show. I hope you enjoyed the show this week. Remember, it's Radiothon time, and with your donation, we can reach our goal. Log on to WJCU.org or call 216-397-4438 and pledge your support. So our question last week elicited little to zero interest. So let's try a different one for this week. If you're planning an organized ride or tour this year, what is it? It can be anything from a one-day fundraiser to a fondo to a week-long ride. I just want to know where you're going. So that's it for this week. I hope you enjoyed our show. We'll be back next week when we speak with Ellie Sias about her company, Cycle of Life Adventures, and a lot more. Please remember to stay safe out there, and if you have a chance, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We hope you enjoyed this week's show and welcome your comments and thoughts on Twitter and Facebook. Visit OutspokenCyclist.com to hear this and all past shows. We'll be back next week with more great conversation and news from the world of cycling. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.